Hey, listeners, before we get going, we have a big favor to ask, and we promise it won't take up too much of your time. You know, our show is supported by some fantastic sponsors. You'll hear about them later in the program. Well, we would love to hear your feedback related to that. Head to podlistenersurvey.com and fill out a short anonymous survey. That's it. That's all you have to do. Take a couple minutes. Again, that's podlistenersurvey, podlistenersurvey.com. Thank you very much. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. On today's show, we'll talk a bit about the news story of the moment and the last election of 2018. Both get at some of the big themes that define our current politics and will continue to for the next couple of years. First, we will touch on that big news story of the moment, the incident at the U.S.-Mexico border where U.S. officers fired tear gas on a group of Central American migrants who rushed the border near San Diego and closed the busiest port of entry between the United States and Mexico. We're trying to get a sense of how we got to this moment, put it in some historical context, and look at how the media is doing covering the caravan and this incident. We're also going to talk about Tuesday's runoff Senate election in Mississippi between Cindy Hyde-Smith and Mike Espy and broaden it to assess the state of the Trump coalition, the power of progressive and racialized politics, and what it all means going into the 2020 election. Heady stuff. Here to discuss it all, Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Hi, Jody.
Wow. You coming off a red eye?
It wasn't supposed to be a red eye. It was supposed to be a black eye. I don't think a black eye.
Yeah, just a late flight.
Just a late flight, right, and it turned into a red eye.
Unintentional red eye is the worst.
Thanks to airline that I shall not name.
Oh, you're not going to tweet about them, tweet complaints about them?
No, because...
That's tacky.
A, it's tacky. And B, you know what? You want honest travel advice? The three big airlines are all the same damn thing. Right, the three big U.S.-based airlines.
Okay.
If you're traveling internationally and you're like, oh, I had a particularly good experience with this carrier, then bank that information. The three big U.S. carriers, all the same damn thing.
Any one of them could turn into an unintentional
I think they go
at
through
any, at any moment.
I think they go through cycles where maybe for like a year or two at a time, one's a little better. But like frequent flyer for a long time and those cycles do, you know, you ride the wave while you can, but yeah.
Claire Malone, senior politics writer. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
I trust your holiday travels were a little less eventful.
They were.
Good. And Micah Cohen.
Hi.
Managing editor. Hello, Micah.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming to the show that you're contractually obligated to come to. Let's begin with the situation at the border and get right into it. So, you know, just to frame it a little bit, what started as a protest by Central American migrants over the slow process for seeking asylum in the United States turned yesterday, Sunday, into a group rushing the border. The Customs and Border Protection Agency responded by firing tear gas into Mexico, then shutting down the border. This has been a bit of a slow building crisis. We've known about this caravan for weeks. There is obviously a long history of asylum seekers at the border. Nate, you want to just jump in and talk about what you make of this moment, and then in particular, if anything in this moment feels new, given that longer history of our border relations?
I don't know if I have zoom out kind of thoughts, Jody.
Okay.
I don't know.
You
I mean, I think in some ways to me, I think immigration is one of those great unknowns where to me, it's actually not clear how much it's directly responsible for shaping the contours of American politics versus being a consequence of other things versus being kind of adjacent to them. So xenophobia or whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think the experience has been from a very narrow, like kind of public opinion standpoint. It seems like immigration related topics do not do much to Trump's approval rating either way. So it seems like things are pretty baked in. And I guess kind of one thought I have is like, you can see very different headlines about this that are probably each in their own way valid, right? You know, I was looking at the New York Post this morning, the headline, it was, you know, kind of migrant crisis or something, crisis at border. Or you can say, oh, here's a picture of tear gas being used and toddlers and families retreating from the border for U.S. tear gas. And so you can definitely like portray it in very different, almost quite opposite ways. You know, I think there's contention over like, do we describe it as a crisis or not? If it is a crisis, kind of whose crisis, you know, who made the crisis? Did the migrants make the crisis or did the U.S./Mexican response make it? Or did it become a crisis when you had people try to cross over the border in big streams and not through the official asylum process? Or, you know, but it's like these are all framing questions. And I suspect when you have a lot of framing questions that like it will tend to have people retreat toward their partisan corners.
I think there are two bits of news about the border over the past couple of days. One is obviously the tear gas and the migrants rushing the border. The other one is the Trump administration and the incoming new Mexican presidential administration and sort of the negotiations over a change in policy. So typically, if a migrant comes into the U.S. or an illegal immigrant comes into the U.S., they are held in the U.S. pending coming before the court. And that's where a lot of people will take advantage and leave and not stay for their court date and sort of enter the country illegally and stay there. The Trump administration is trying to work out a deal where those people will be held not in the United States, but in Mexico. That's where Trump is coming out with all this stuff that says we're going to end catch and release. So there are a couple different things that are happening right now when it comes to immigration policy. And I would just pop in here Hillary Clinton's comments about European migration over the, I think it was over the weekend, where she said European nations really need to stem the flow of immigrants, of migrants, and not have open borders.
She said it because it leads to a backlash in politics.
And I thought it was interesting because it was, in some ways, Hillary Clinton, I think, has always been a bit more, hawkish is the wrong word here, but she does have that tendency toward, you know, centrism. And I would say it's kind of, you know, it's sort of like a more last decade Democratic Party line, right, where it's actually saying, like, we need to have limits on immigration, let's be sensible about this. And it was sort of, to me, an interesting statement from someone who's, she sort of rid herself of the, I guess, the chains of having to appeal to a party base that's becoming more liberal. So those were sort of the three points of interesting news globally about immigration, I think.
I mean, could you also say that, like, she was making excuses? And I mean, I don't know, right?
Making excuses for what?
So if you're kind of a neoliberal like Hillary Clinton, then you say, you know, what happened to my electoral coalition, what happened to the electoral coalition of other people in that same generation. And it seems like people reach and say, oh, the migration or immigration is a big part of it. I don't know. I mean, I ask this like sincerely, like, is there settled scholarship or not scholarship or consensus about like whether that's really true or not? I mean, it seems to be a more powerful force in Germany, where the refugee flows are fairly large in some countries relative to historical trends.
Wait, if what is true?
Whether it's true that, like, immigration is a cause of
right-wing
populist backlash.
Of white, to simplify, white working class voters who used to vote Democratic now moving
in the U.S.
No, and I think the answer could be that yes in Europe and not in the U.S. might be a valid answer because the immigration flows are larger in Europe. You know, I think in Europe it's a risk going to territory that I'm not quite as familiar with. I'm not sure that it's as much of an elites versus kind of working class divide in Europe, and they're certainly part of that, and you see polarization within Europe to the extent I can tell what's going on there. It does seem like in Europe there is a higher fraction of elite opinion that is anti-immigration more than in the U.S. maybe. Again, in the U.S., the number of illegal immigrants has not been especially high. It's been down, I think, actually.
Do you want an example of that? Here's a quote from Tony Blair, who says, you've got to deal with the legitimate grievances and answer them, which is why today in Europe you cannot possibly stand for election unless you've got a strong position on immigration because people are worried about it. You've got to answer those problems. If you don't answer them, then you leave a large space into which populists can march. So I guess that's an example of high-profile elite opinion in Europe.
That's sort of what Clinton is saying, right?
Right.
Yeah, but I guess to complete my thought, it does seem problematic that if you kind of lump together Europe and the U.S., because in Europe you at least have this increase, in the U.S. you have a leveling off, right? And so it seems weird to like take all those into account. If it's populism and the U.S. populism is equivalent to European populism, that would actually be evidence that maybe it's not related to immigration. It can be related to demonizing of immigrants.
There's a rhetorical element to it, regardless of whether the numbers back it up. So, Micah, do you want to jump in on?
Yeah, a couple things. So one is the Clinton comment made me think of something Claire said a long time ago that has always just kind of stuck in my head, and I think it's really true, which is that Democrats don't really have a message on immigration that works. They have positioned themselves as against certain Republican policies. But if I came to an average voter and said, hey, tell me in two sentences what the Democratic position on immigration is, I don't think you'd get an answer that Chuck Schumer would like, probably. Either they wouldn't know, or it'd be something, if you talked to a more conservative voter, it would be something like, oh, they want open borders or something.
Abolish ICE.
Which isn't really true. But again, they've left this vacuum. The other thing is, and I sort of think this is what Nate was getting at a moment ago, but I think people are treating this too much as an issue that has a direct effect on voters. Like, that seems how to be how Clinton is treating, which, again, might be true in Europe. I don't know. But I feel like it's just more of a proxy for other things in the U.S., where, as was mentioned, in terms of like the data people use to look at how much illegal immigration there is, it's like at an all-time low. I mean, it's up a little bit year over year, but like in the broad sweep of history, it's way down. So I kind of think immigration now is what, you know, welfare was in the 90s or crime was in the 90s, which is to say an issue that people use and that captures a lot of racialized feelings or racist feelings or, you know, the opposite of racist feelings, you know, where the parties are much better sorted now by whether you have liberal views on race or, quote unquote, conservative views on race.
But Trump himself seems to be convinced that there's a direct connection between talking about immigration and electoral outcomes. I mean, there's a reason they started talking about the caravan in the weeks leading up to it. There's a reason that I don't know if he's commented specifically on the tear gassing at the border, but he's in the last couple of days talked about closing the border, you know, and sort of using that language out loud. I don't think this is in opposition to what you were just saying, but I mean, someone out there is convinced that there's an electoral math here, right?
Trump understands that one of the parts of his victory was speaking codedly or kind of not about race. And I think that's kind of what immigration has become, right? It's for those of us who came of age in the 20th century, we talked a lot about black-white relations in the U.S., and obviously that's still there. But I think Trump knows to talk about race and to appeal to a certain part of his base by, yeah, hammering on immigration as a policy issue, but what's coded within that is the racial issue that people respond to on a gut level.
Yeah.
But on both sides.
On both sides, right.
Yeah.
The question of whether the rhetoric has an effect is separate from whether the issue has an effect, though. So, like, what Blair was saying in that quote is, hey, this migration in Europe is changing people's lives economically, socially, in a way they don't like, and therefore that is affecting their voting behavior, and you need a message for that.
I would also say that perhaps it is because Europe suffered a lot more terrorist attacks,
right.
ISIS-sponsored attacks in the past, let's call it 4 years, I think it has become more – politicians need to respond to that on the right and the left because I think it has become such a public safety fear of the European public. While that specter is sort of, you know, drawn in the U.S. of, you know, ISIS could be coming in here, we have had fewer of those attacks.
Right.
You know, we are usually, you know, the homegrown – mentally ill gunmen, right? That's the American terrorist attack versus migrant-inspired terrorist attack.
Now, whether Trump talking about immigration has a political electoral effect is a separate question. I think I don't know what you think, Nate, but I'm probably more open to that in the sense that GOP turnout was high in 2018.
I mean, I think it's one of these things that galvanizes or contributes to the divides we see, which is increasingly an urban-rural divide and a cosmopolitan, non-cosmopolitan divide. I mean, I do think it's somewhat significant that you do see also rise in anti-Semitic mm-hmm. rhetoric, because there is kind of like, who are you allowed to blame for your problems if you're not satisfied with your situation? And which things are you allowed to say kind of out loud versus having to dog whistle? And it seems like illegal immigrants are one of the groups that you don't have to dog whistle about, right? You can say we should all agree they should apply, except for a few Democrats on the far left, right? We all agree that they should apply through some orderly process. We can all agree that people who have paid their dues are hardworking Americans and part of our community, but illegals, blah, 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 right? Now, the fact that places where you actually have a lot of illegal or unauthorized migration tend to be fairly democratic is an interesting, you know, counter to this. And the fact that border states like Texas and Arizona and certainly California were some of Democrats' best results, at least on a relative basis, in this midterm, you know, that's pretty interesting.
By the way, I just want to drop in here because we're floating between, we started this conversation talking about migrants at the border, many of whom are asylum seekers. And I do think we want to just clarify that we understand that like that is an element of all of this. And we were talking earlier about the discussed changes of keeping asylum seekers in Mexico rather than holding them in the U.S. where they would be released. And this is a quote from someone who's an ACLU attorney, Lee Gellert, in the Washington Post. He says, "We have not seen a specific proposal, but any policy that would leave individuals stranded in Mexico would inevitably put people in danger. the administration, they're saying that they're going to consider triggering legal challenges because I think there's some potential violation to asylum seeker rights, which have been, you know, enshrined. So I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an immigration specialist, but I just want to clarify what we're talking about when we talk about the hoops that people are talking about.
And whether it's asylum seekers or immigration more generally, I just think like this is a catch-all issue and a proxy issue. And I'd like to be really blunt about it. It's a way for, you know, in the 1990s, the way that politicians said to white people, hey, we're looking out for you, was by talking about crime or by talking about the welfare, like even in the 80s, right, mm-hmm. with Reagan. I think the way you do it now is immigration. And Trump has done a lot of that. And to me, the real question is, okay, so let's say for the next 2 years, this is what we have. You know, whether this is a Trump-made crisis at the border or a crisis, an organic crisis, it's certainly going to be at the center of the conversation because Trump is going to make it at the center of the conversation. So like what effect that has on the body politic, I think, is the question. And I don't know, judging by 2018, I sort of think it's not enough for Republicans.
Yeah.
So is it worth just taking a beat and talking a bit about the media angle here? Nate, you kind of started getting there at the very beginning of this conversation. So whether it's about this incident in particular or the way that we saw the sort of caravan covered in the weeks leading up to the election, do you want to paint the contours of how you see the media covering this? How should they cover it? Is it happening on Trump's terms? Is the media sort of have their head around this?
I don't know how the media should cover it because it is one of these situations where you can contribute to an environment where it becomes more of a crisis or higher stakes. And then, you know, and then the fact that like, okay, maybe we shouldn't be sending all these people down to the border and having this big confrontation. The fact is that we are, and therefore it becomes a story to a certain degree. You know, I think now is different as compared to when they were thousands of miles or hundreds of miles away and Trump was kind of hyping it on the campaign trail. I mean, that was kind of nakedly cynical. And we saw that, like, he didn't really talk very much about the caravan for a week or two after the midterm until it actually came and approached. You know, I mean, I think it's a real news story now. You know, I wouldn't want to, I guess we do have to make decisions about, like, what things are called and how it's framed. You know, I do tend to think, again, the fact that you have visuals from the story that are pretty powerful in both directions is significant.
I keep on thinking, I mean, I think the visuals parallel is, do you guys remember the picture of the drowned Syrian child that, you know, that migrant crisis had been going on for a year and a half. And then that picture came out and it kind of caught fire with the media, I would say. And I think this goes to the power of visuals and the fact that in some way the migrant caravan has provided, I mean, not just a political talking point, but it is this sort of remarkable, it's remarkable that people kind of decided we're going to band together and maybe the strength is in numbers, that provides an arresting visual for photographers. Then it makes people want to go down to the border and sort of see what the caravan is all about. You hear a lot of stories of suffering and then there's a lot of kids there. I mean, that's just sort of the unavoidable part of this whole crisis is there are a lot of kids in those photos who are, you know, crying. You had the kids in the detention centers earlier this year. And I do think that, in these cases, like some of this is just the visuals that really get people because there was an unaccompanied minor crisis at the border happening during the Obama administration. And I would say it was largely it was obviously covered, but it was relegated to, I mean, I hate to say this, but like serious publications that people don't really read the articles.
There was a skirmish in 2013 that involved not tear gas but pepper spray at the border as well, and it wasn't covered in the way we're seeing now.
Right. So I do think some of this is just it's the visuals. It's the narrative arc of like these are these hundreds of people who are all marching together, and you know some of them are you see lots of signs and protests of we hate Trump, things like that. It's almost like the photo documentation of sort of the personification of the debate that we're having left, right in the U.S.
If you go to the different news websites, so it's a big headline on MSNBC, U.S. fires tear gas on migrants trying to rush across border.
What's the photo?
It's a woman carrying a woman with a child. Mm-hmm. Yeah. On Fox News, the headline, selective outrage. ? Dems blast Trump over border confrontation, but migrants were pepper sprayed in 2013 too.
And there's a picture of Obama and Trump.
Picture of Obama and Trump and a bunch of people with pickup trucks in Tijuana, I guess.
Yeah.
And then
at the Washington Post and the New York Times, it's actually like the third or fourth headline, right? And so I think this is kind of a cable news story more than it's a New York Times, Washington Post story.
And the third or fourth headline seems about right to me. And even like I was looking at the Times story. The Times story has a picture of people trying to climb the fence, but then also a picture of like a mom with her two kids, one in a diaper, being pulled away from tear gas.
This, yeah, the cable news thing is a really good point. I mean, I came up in journalism in print magazines only, and I think having worked for the past 3 years at television majority companies, ESPN and now ABC as the parent companies, you do realize that there are, it's a different, it's news, but it's visual. Also, the visual components are such a big thing. So if you are television, you need visuals. You need something that conveys to your viewers what's happening, and it needs to be, I don't mean to use this in a bad taste, but exciting, right? Like that is new. That's why we cover storms with such gusto. Now, obviously, they have huge effects on people's lives, but there's a reason why you have the news anchor shot of someone, you know, like in the wind. So there is this different component of a lot of Americans consume their news via television, not via morning newspaper.
Well, and this was made for that. The only other thing I'd say, though, is like this is a hard story to, Nate was saying at this at the beginning, to get the framing right, whether you frame it as a political ploy from Trump or a genuine human crisis at the border. If that, who's to blame? What policies are helping or hurting it? You know, how does it fit in the historical context? All that is really hard, and I think some places are getting it more right than others. One thing I'd say, though, is like part of the conversation that has annoyed me a little bit is this idea that the media is playing into Trump's hands by covering what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Which I think there are elements of that I think are totally right and correct. Like Trump's playing up with the caravan before the election was clearly an electoral and a political ploy and should have been covered in that light. That said, like, look, Trump was elected president. And part of what you get to do when you're elected president, because you represent the people, is have outsized influence on the conversation. You know, and there's an element, I think, where the media and commenters in the media have never sort of accepted that Trump won and so aren't willing to grant him sort of the basic privileges that come with being president that were assumed of other presidents. You know, every president tries to manipulate the conversation to their political benefit, right?
Yeah.
Trump might do it.
It doesn't always work.
I think so actually, we were talking about what's the top news on the different various sites. I mean, the top news on the New York Times is extremely unfavorable to Trump, which is that General Motors just cut a huge number of North American jobs, including the Lordstown plant, which is this massive plant in Youngstown. I mean, you drive by it and it's just like, it's huge. They're completely closing it down. That devastates the Youngstown area, which is high Trumpsville. According to General Motors, the Lordstown plant is responsible for more than $181 million in wages and pays more than $35 million in salary taxes. I mean, that's a huge... Trump goes to Ohio and says, we're bringing back the jobs, right? This is a huge plant closing. It's a North American plant closing. But the migrant crisis is a good distraction, if we're being honest, from like a pretty bad economic story for a part of Trump's base. So you're right, Micah. Like, it is a very... It's advantageous. It's the advantage of the White House, and its advantage of, you know, the earned media that we know that Trump has mastered so well in the past 3 years. And it's just, I mean, it's interesting to watch play out on a day like today. You know, the economic story leads the Times, and I would guess the Journal will probably do that. But cable and stuff will continue probably with the migrant stuff.
See what the Journal has.
What does the Journal have?
Okay, quick update on the Journal, and then we'll move on.
GM idle factories.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so we are going to leave it there. Good news or bad news is that I don't see any of these questions going away, and they are things we will continue to talk about. But right now, we will not continue to talk about them because we're going to move on to our next segment, which is about the Senate election in Mississippi. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by GiveWell. Many people want to give to good charities. It is that time of year, but have a hard time figuring out how to maximize how they can accomplish the most for every dollar that they give. GiveWell does in-depth, detailed research to identify evidence-backed, cost-effective programs helping the poorest people in the world. It's at its website, givewell.org. You can see a very short list of top charities that have met GiveWell's exacting standards. GiveWell is unique because it focuses on how much good a charity accomplishes. For example, how many lives does it save, or how much does someone's income increase with each dollar donated, instead of easier to answer but perhaps less important questions like how much a charity's CEO makes or how much overhead it has. Its current top charities do things like fund programs to prevent child deaths from malaria or provide direct cash transfers to very poor households in East Africa. All of the details of GiveWell's work are available for free on its website. GiveWell deeply vets scientific evidence for programs. Its charity reviews are accompanied by hundreds of footnotes. We know how much you love footnotes. Do good with your dollars right now. Go to givewell.org. Once again, that's givewell.org. All right, we're back. And tomorrow, folks, we couldn't let go of the 2018 election that easily. Tomorrow is election day, at least in Mississippi. There's a runoff between Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith and Democrat Mike Espy after no candidate reached a majority earlier this month. It's technically a nonpartisan election. It's just amazing to even say those words out loud. The parties won't appear on the ballot, but the race is anything but nonpartisan. It's drawing out a number of larger fault lines that both Democrats and Republicans will have to reckon with in the coming years. Let's start, before we get to some of those bigger themes, with the election itself. Nate, do Democrats really have a shot at winning a statewide race in Mississippi?
Define a shot, dude.
No, you define a shot, dude.
Define a shot, man.
At least a 20% chance.
20% is, I don't know, it'd probably be somewhere in that.
One in five.
Do I know what the Scottish teens think?
Okay, tell us what the Scottish teens think, and then tell us about the state of polling.
The Scottish teenagers.
On the prediction market, for people who don't get
this
reference.
On Predicted.
Yeah.
Currently, it's slow to load.
This is how Nate kills time when his Wi-Fi is not working.
They give Mike Espy, the Democrat, an 8.4% chance, and Cindy Hyde-Smith, the Republican, a 91.5% chance.
Seems about right.
Chance.
Let's say Espy has a 1 in 10 chance.
Okay.
I think it's probably too low, just because, like, the uncertainty is very high, because I think you're going to have fairly low turnout. I mean, you know, the problem for Espy is he lost by a bunch. If you take the combined share for both parties in the preliminary round, I guess the primary technically, then Republicans won that by like 16 or 17 points. So he needs a bunch of people who voted for McDaniel, the more Tea Party, I was going to say more wacky, but like, you know, don't want to like either. I don't want to describe any zone of wackiness around Hyde-Smith that she's by implication excluded from. But like, I should put it like this. There's only one poll of the race. It's a weird race. It's going to be low turnout. If I spend a lot of time building a model or something, then it might, I don't know, my hunch is that it would be a little higher than 8. Mm-hmm. It might be double that. It might be 15 or something.
So why just is because, there only one poll of the race? It seems,
it's, I don't know. I think it's because,
it's,
I think it's because, like,
Senate race?
It is a little weird, right? Out of all things to, you know, this is a lot more interesting, for example, than the Florida recount, mm-hmm. which it became fairly clear fairly early on that it wasn't going to change the outcome. I know. I think Mississippi is not a state networks are used to polling much. There were not many polls of this race in the primary stage either. You know, I think pollsters are afraid to take risks on states that aren't Florida or Ohio, or states where they feel like they have a good grasp on the demographics. My inference is the way that Hyde-Smith could lose is because it could be fairly low turnout. And part of the reason why is that, like, it's actually not that high stakes. Not that you shouldn't turn into the 538 live blog tomorrow. but it's a seat you have for 2 years, and it's up again in 2020. So you don't get, you
as
know,
is Alabama. With similar,
as is Alabama.
Dynamics. So those are two interesting things to watch.
So you don't get that much of a, you get a little bit of an incumbency advantage. And I guess if SB won, then it's easier to imagine him losing or holding on than if he were to lose and run again or something in 2020. With that said, it's a fairly short term prize. I'm not sure for the short term 52 versus 53 seats.
Right.
Matters all that much, although maybe 52 can be problematic.
Can you explain to people Mississippi's inelasticity?
And Mississippi is pretty inelastic.
And what does that mean?
Elasticity is our concept for how responsive, it's a term borrowed from economics, how responsive a particular state or district is to overall change in the national mood. Basically, it's asking, are there a lot of swing voters in the state? Typically in the South, you can have states that are fairly close, say North Carolina, but it's because you have, on the one hand,
black voters and college-educated white people, and on the other hand, like really conservative evangelical white people, and that breaks down roughly 50-50. In Mississippi, probably the same thing. You have very few actual swing voters. You have a white evangelical population. Mississippi, even relative to Alabama, for example, does not have a ton of college-educated voters, not have what you would call like a big city, really, even in the sense that you have in Birmingham, for example. You also have, like, I think it has, like, the highest or the second highest share of African-American population in the country. And yeah. So, you know, Mississippi, you're going to get your Democrat with 43% and your Republican with 57%. And there's, like, not a whole lot that can really be done to shift that, because the Democrats winning 95% of the black vote, the Republicans winning 83% of the white vote, and we know where there are black people and white people in Mississippi.
And I think the natural comparison to make here is the Alabama election from last year. So there's some parallels in the sense of, like, it's more of a shot than other, I guess, deep South states would have of flipping the seat. But with Roy Moore running against Doug Jones, Roy Moore had a real full-blown bad scandal on his hands, right? Molestation of underage girls. Cindy Hyde-Smith has said some really bad things, I would say, or extremely racially tinged things. But it's in a state that has a terrible racial history. But it is not this, I think it is not the same sort of stomach-turning reaction that people had to Roy Moore, the accusations against Roy Moore. And I also think the other thing that we should talk about is, you know, so Doug Jones, the Democrats' way to victory was turn out a lot of African-American voters and, you know, either win over some white swing voters or, you know, have them stay home, right? And he ended up doing that. Doug Jones, we should point out, is a middle-aged white centrist Democrat. And SB is a black man in the South. Then I do think that that makes a big difference about winning over, you know, if we're talking about the slim chances that you have for victory of winning over white swing voters if they're out there in Mississippi. I mean, let's just be frank about the racial component of the race.
No, and this isn't dispositive, but see Andrew Gillum in Florida, where Nelson, I think somewhat surprisingly, Bill Nelson, the senator, didn't he end up outperforming Gillum? Which we thought it would
be.
Well,
it was almost a tie.
Okay. The other thing is, I thought Nathaniel Rakich, who had a preview of the race up this morning, had a useful way to think about it, which is like, if this election, if the runoff plays out like a special election, then SB has a chance, which is to say Mississippi is about 15, 16 points more Republican-leaning than the country overall. Democrats in the average special election in the Trump era have outperformed the partisan lean of the state or district by about 16 points. So, like, if this plays out like a special election, yeah, maybe SB could eke it out. You know, that would take basically Republicans not turning out, Democratic enthusiasm being high, them turning out, and just like a lopsided electorate for a weirdly scheduled race. If it plays out like the midterms, where the regularly scheduled midterms, where Democratic enthusiasm was high, but Republican voters turned out too, then you would expect SB to outperform the partisan lean in Mississippi, but not by enough to win the race. So to me, one question I have actually is, which Nathaniel brought up, is like, well, now that Democrats have won the House and control of the Senate isn't at stake here, does Democratic enthusiasm sort of not work to the same advantage that it would if this were scheduled, you know?
Or if this were like the deciding vote or whatever, right?
Well, I don't know if you had that much enthusiasm in Mississippi.
To begin with.
To begin with, none of the races there are close. You have one very black district and everything else is very red. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, to me, it does feel more like a special election kind of in terms of the level of attention to it, which I know is a little arbitrary, but it does feel like one of those weird, like 2017 special elections. You've only seen one poll. I would imagine that even among people listening to this show, probably not a ton of people who are like, oh my God, I kind of cancel my evening plans tomorrow.
You're really selling this live blog.
But you guys have to come to the live blog.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
there's so much good stuff in the live blog.
I'm canceling my evening plans for the live blog.
Well, I had to, yeah. I was going to go to some play. I had to reschedule.
Oh, boy. Oh, folks. Okay. Look, I want to take a quick break, and then we'll come back. We'll get final thoughts on the race itself, but then for the last part of the show, maybe even broaden it a bit and talk about some of the bigger themes that Claire and Micah were starting to get at. But let's take a quick break, because I need to tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. With the weather getting colder, the struggle to get out of bed in the morning is real. And Casper Mattress makes it so tempting to hide under the covers and stay cozy. It's hands down the most comfortable mattress around. When you switch to Casper, you will have a high-quality mattress at an affordable price that you will never want to leave. Sleep comfortably every night and never wake up overheated thanks to the unique combination of foams that provide the right pressure relief and alignment. Casper ships right to your door for free in a box that will make you say, how do they do that? How is there a mattress inside a box that small? But there is. There is a mattress. They wouldn't do that to you. There is a mattress inside of that box. They will come and even pick it up if you don't love it and refund you everything from its engineering to its packaging to letting you try it for 100 nights for free. It's no wonder that Casper has over 35,000 five-star reviews on all of their products across Casper, Google, and Amazon. Now is the perfect time to try Casper for yourself or give Casper as a gift to someone you care about. Head to Casper.com and save 10% on your order right now with any Casper mattress. That's Casper.com. Terms and conditions apply. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. The holidays are approaching and you may be thinking about how you are going to save some extra money. Well, here is a way that maybe you haven't thought of. Consolidate your high interest credit card balances to a lower rate and save with Lightstream. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 6.14% APR with autopay. You can compare that to the average credit card interest rate nationally of over 19% APR. Get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and you can get your money as soon as the day you apply. Right now, you can save even more with an additional interest rate discount by going to lightstream.com/538. That is Lightstream, L-I-G-H-T, stream, S-T-R-E-A-M, I can spell, .com/538. Subject to credit approval, rates include 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Right now, again, that website, lightstream.com/538 for more information and to apply today. All right, we're back, and sort of building on some of the things that we were discussing, the larger trends that we see in the Mississippi election, let's broaden this a bit, because during the midterms, Democrats overperformed in the suburbs in the South, but they didn't do so well among rural whites. This, of course, reflected a national trend. And there was this Times piece that came out over the weekend that got a lot of people in our circles talking that portrayed that dynamic as a bit of a roadblock, particularly for progressive Democrats to winning elections like the Mississippi Senate race. So, Nate, I don't know if you want to talk about that Times article in particular, or just this larger question of, is alienating rural whites a long-term risk for Democrats?
You know, one of the people in this room is my editor.
Uh-huh.
And what my editor is not aware of is that I have downloaded a whole data set, or had someone procure me a data set where you have precinct level results. And we're going to go and dive in and see how much can you learn from density.
Why are you scooping yourself?
Yeah.
No, go for it.
No, what happens when you well, because I haven't done any of the work yet, right? So I don't know. But it's like, how much can you learn from
a red eye? Yeah.
What are the consequences of a world in which everything is density driven, right? Where Democrats win urban cores by huge margins, extended cities by solid margins, right? Suburbs by some amount, then it goes to exurbs, right? What's the consequence of that? I mean, I do think one consequence of that is that you actually wind up training strength in the Midwest for strength in the Sun Belt, because people don't think of it this way because these states are like physically very large.
Yeah.
But actually, states like Nevada or Arizona or Texas are pretty urbanized, and Texas increasingly so, especially where these metro areas are getting really big in Texas. And so, you know, so urbanization is probably actually helpful to Democrats in states like those. And so I thought the article was weird because, number one, it has this thesis that like, oh, look, Beto O'Rourke, Stacey Abrams, and Gillum are an example of how the strategy failed because it did really poorly in rural areas, right?
You know, the strategy being running to the left, sort of embracing progressivism.
So a couple of critiques. One is that, like, I don't think I would put Beto in the same categories as the other two. I mean, Beto, kind of his whole thing is like, he's the, you know, the reasonable white guy, basically. And he's trying to, like, he's not really running that far to the left. He also has been in Congress for three terms and has a voting record, which is not... It's mainstream Democrat, actually in a very liberal district, though. And so he's not particularly pushing the envelope to the left. You know, the other thing is that, like, it kind of misses the forest for the trees a little bit, where Texas Democrats did a lot better than they do traditionally. And so in Texas, the lesson to me is that, like, yes, Beto can do worse in rural areas than actually the no-name Democrat did 6 years ago against Cruz, and yet come much closer to beating Cruz because Texas is actually an urban state. And because there isn't a ton of limit on how much you can run up those margins in Dallas or Houston, and those are big cities. So on the one hand, I'm not sure if like Beto is a good example of like what effect a progressive would have anyway. You know, on the other hand, like I think it's missing the big story a little bit, which is that like urban areas in the South are voting like urban areas in the north.
Yeah.
And if that weren't true, then like Democrats' strategy of having like extreme concentration in coastal urban areas would be really problematic if it was only in like the Northeast and the West Coast. If, however, it's also in the South and the Southwest, then that's a lot different.
Yeah, that Times article used SB's campaign a little bit as, you know, the jumping off point where they were talking about his reaction to Hyde Smith's lynching comments. And he, you know, he didn't have a huge, you know, bombastic response to it. And the thesis was, well, he's trying to not alienate white suburban voters, which makes sense for Mississippi with state that doesn't have a lot of urban areas where you'd be ginning up like this big progressive outrage. It made me sort of think of a recent profile I read of Deval Patrick in The New Yorker, because Patrick and Espy are two black candidates who, when they talk about, they're kind of trying to be in the Obama mold, I would say, like the happy warrior who isn't getting caught up in the inflamed outrage, right? In part because I think stereotypes of angry black men and not wanting to like fall into these traps and still remain electorally viable with white voters. And so they're taking, you know, it's sort of like a different, I guess, you know, a little bit of an appeasement, not, you know, not falling into the progressive maelstrom. And, you know, the New Yorker profile ended with the question of, yeah, but does this work anymore, right? Does the Obama thing work anymore? Because we've talked a lot about how Obama's presidency kind of activated some sense of identification within voters, that certain parties echoed their feelings about race in a political way. I'm just coming from Ohio, and I talked politics with friends and family. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about the idea that, you know, Ohio might be, this is, I mean, at least the people I talk to, Ohio might be off the board as far as a swing state. You know, there's only one statewide Democratic elected official. And, you know, we're talking about who are the 2020 Democratic nominees. And everyone I talked to, white and not white, said, well, I think Ohio is, and the kind of voters that are in Ohio who used to vote Democratic, you can't put anyone but like Joe Biden in front of them, right? And I think that there is that sort of, I mean, this is sort of tangential, but, you know, the idea that Gillum and SB, Gillum was running a different kind of race than SB is, than Deval Patrick would run, you know, the idea of like, you kind of can't avoid the identity politics, I think, in 2020, but it does also take certain states off the map that you're going to get a lot of pushback about from like traditional Democratic strategists. And I don't think it's a guaranteed way to winning.
My like main thought about this is, remember the those kind folks from PBS who interviewed us, and they asked us if we could change one thing about the media, what would we change? And my answer, and this is like a perfect example of it, was that the media would be better at choosing which tool in its journalistic toolkit they should use to answer what question. The thesis here is basically,
this is of the Times piece.
Yeah. The thesis here is basically, more progressive Democrats lost more of the rural white vote. Here's a paragraph. The campaigns of Stacey Abrams in Georgia, Andrew Gillum in Florida, and Beto O'Rourke in Texas may have electrified black and progressive white voters, blah, 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 but they had an equal and opposite effect as well. In rural county after rural county, this trio of next generation Democrats performed worse than President Obama did in 2012. This is like just a horrible way to go about answering this question. First of all, why are you looking at those three candidates only, right? Is there every other person on the ballot doesn't count? How do you how are you categorizing people who speak boldly versus people who don't? I just think that this idea that, I guess that, you know, more progressive candidates will cost Democrats more votes in among rural white voters. Yeah, that might be true. I don't have particular evidence that it's not true. But like Obama was pretty progressive.
Yeah, it's a little weird to compare to Obama's numbers in 2012. Joe Manchin, by the way, who was on the ballot in 2012, saw his numbers really deteriorate. I mean, all of West Virginia is pretty rural, but right. Really, really lost a lot of ground in rural areas. I mean, someone who voted for Kavanaugh and
yeah, like, don't we think the political environment has changed a lot since 2012? And people, yeah, like, this no, is, right. You're right. This is what we're saying. It's like, it's hard. It's a little hard to compare Obama 2012 to the candidates in 2018, because the political landscape has changed.
Well,
so
that's a thing. Yeah. It's like rural white voters all over the country are moving to the Republican Party and have been for years. So like Democrats who speak boldly risk alien. Like this is
I think it speaks to. So this goes back to the Ohio thing, which is like people in these increasing like in blue dots in red states. I think they do realize that there is an electoral calculation and strategy being made and that they are now being discounted, you know, like a full on red state. They're like, well, we got to appeal to the people who are going to win us this state, which is working class whites. And we don't think we have those people anymore. So like this state is gone. Right. And now we're moving on to the next state. And I think that in some ways I understand that we're taking issue with the methodology of the Times or the thesis of the Times thing. But I do think what it is articulating is the idea that Democrats now realize starkly that they are making really bifurcated appeals, right? And it might eliminate certain states. I find myself increasingly going back to this like a little bit of a class thing or a little bit of like a worldview. Like they're bifurcating worldviews. So they'll say the worldview of Arizona is more useful to us now than the predominant worldview in Arizona is more useful to us now than the predominant worldview of Ohio. There are too many rural non-college educated white voters in Ohio. See you later. Right. Which is why you'll get, you know, Ohio voters saying, just bring us Ohio Democratic voters saying, bring us Joe Biden and we'll win the state again. Right. And I think Jonathan Martin in that piece was trying to sort of delineate like the psychological struggle that Democrats are having with that, where they're realizing how hard their message is splitting states and voters and populations.
But I'm very dubious of the idea that bring us Joe Biden again and all of a sudden Ohio's back, you know.
It's totally fair. I'm just like I'm trying to articulate the psychology of these people, of Democrats in these increasingly red states.
Completely, but like, look, do Democrats have a problem with rural white voters? Yeah, they do.
But it's not necessarily scanning across whether you're progressive or you're more moderate. It might just be a Democratic problem in rural white areas.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So
it
just
it might be
right.
But no one, you know, I haven't seen that. This doesn't show that. And like to Nate's point. Your Manchin, who's like, it was basically about as conservative as you can get as a Democrat,
right.
Also did shitty in rural areas. So, like, the Democratic Party definitely has a problem with these voters, but it's just the mirror of Republicans have a deep problem with non-white voters in urban areas, right?
So we should start to wrap up here, and I know that a big part of our conversation has been we don't want to make any big, broad statements, but it does feel like just listening to this, like we're nibbling around this idea that maybe the way to start to look at politics is along this urban-rural divide rather than talk about different regions or different states. I mean, should we sort of adjust our thinking going into 2020 and say what really matters is whether you have a D or a R next to the candidate's name and whether the voter is in a city or in a rural area?
I mean, one thing about geography, and it pertains both to geography in the sense of which state you're in and in the sense of like urban versus rural, is like it can be a proxy for a lot of other things. Yeah. And so if you had like a very detailed voter file and you were trying to account for how much does her urbanization status affect her vote relative to if you know her education level and whatever else, right? So that's an empirical question that I'm not sure I have the answer to yet. Although my intuition is that it's probably fairly high. I mean, it really is. Like you can really see that the outline of the cities, and there are fewer and fewer exceptions. You know, you have a couple of rural areas where, you know, still parts of Minnesota, parts where you have like black voters in the South that are rural in the South, right?
Yeah.
But not many exceptions, and even fewer exceptions where you have Republicans doing well in cities. You know, I think the largest city won by Trump in 2016 was either Jacksonville or Oklahoma City, which are cities that are a pretty far down the population ranking list and also cities that are kind of spread out. So the center parts of the cities might not be so Republican. And you had Democrat won in the Oklahoma City district for Congress this year.
Yeah.
And so
I guess I would wish that we would be, you bring up a good point, Nate, that like, you know, urban rural divide. Well, there are lots of rural blacks in the South who vote incredibly Democratic, which is starting to put certain states on the map. But I guess I would, I mean, I just think we need to stop being so euphemistic in some ways. And so when we talk about urban-rural divides, let's say what we really mean, which is a class divide, which is we're talking about an education and race divide. And I think the regional differences are true, right? You know, population center versus non-population center. But I do think that it, and this is more like a reportorial thing than rather than a data thing, but I just think that we do need to stop being euphemistic and say what we really mean, which is It is places that lack economic opportunity, that have racial animus against minorities, versus places that are more diverse, that increasingly get more of the economic opportunities flowing to them, you know, in this sort of cyclical way that we see Amazon coming to two of the wealthiest places in the United States, rather than, you know, there was this years-long, you know, parade where lots of mid-tier cities got their hopes up that places would come to them. So I do wish, I mean, all these things are right. It's urban versus rural. But I do think that some of that is also euphemistic, where let's talk about its class, its race, its education. It's not as easily slotted into boxes, but that's what's happening. Class.
Two things real quick. One is, there is still some regional variation, though. Like, Democrats did a lot worse in suburbs in the South than they did in other regions in the country. But the second thing is, The Economist had this analysis, which they looked at. I guess they must have used the exit poll data, but they looked at kind of what characteristics had the strongest effect on which party you were voting for. What characteristics were the most predictive? And basically, so in terms of probability of voting Republican, far and away the best predictor was being a born-again, church-going Protestant, followed by being white, followed by living in a rural area, right? Then comes being a man. So rural is up there, as Claire was saying, but it's mixed in with these other things. In terms of voting, probability of you voting Democratic, number one, being black, number two, or maybe number one, being an atheist, being LGBTQ, having a postgraduate degree, and then like living in a city, being a woman. So there's some difference here by party in terms of which characteristic predicts which way you're going to vote. Certainly living in a rural area is very predictive of voting Republican, but like it's mixed in with all these other things, which I don't know. It would take, I think, a more careful analysis to show like what is the – it kind of goes back to the immigration conversation. What is the causal variable in this mix? You know, I don't know.
Or more and more, all these things are just so closely linked that you can't really disaggregate.
You can't separate.
Yeah. Actually, you know, maybe that's a good fodder for a future conversation on this podcast or a future article or something. But we are going to wrap it up there. But Nate, since you were doing such a just thrilling job of selling the live blog earlier, you want to just end with one last note about we are live blogging tomorrow night, Tuesday night.
Tomorrow night.
What can people
expect?
What time
does it start?
Okay, good.
What time does it start, Micah?
I've been told 8.
8 o'clock.
That's 8 Eastern.
8 Eastern.
Getting the game back
7
together.
7 Central, 6 Mountain, 5 Pacific. It's
going.
The 538 Mississippi Senate live blog on 538.com.
Perfect. All right. We're going to leave it there. Thank you, Nate Silver.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire Malone.
Thanks.
Thanks to you, Micah Cohen.
Thank you.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us, podcasts@538.com. Don't forget to join us for that live blog tomorrow, Tuesday night. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.